Side 3, The Boat of a Million Years, by Powell Anderson, continuing on page 63. 7. While Roman and Persian bled each other to exhaustion, afar in Makkah, Muhammad ibn Abdallah saw visions, preached, must flee to Yathrib, prevailed over his enemies, gave his refuge the new name Madinat Rasulallah, the city of the Apostle of God, and died as master of Arabia. His Khalifa, successor, Abu Bakr, suppressed rebellion and launched in earnest those holy wars that united the people and carried the faith out across the world. 6 years after the troops of Emperor Heraclius reclaimed Tadmor, the troops of Khalifa Omar took it. The year after that they were in Jerusalem, and the year after that the Khalifa visited the holy city, passing triumphant through a completely subjugated Syria, while couriers brought accounts of Islamic banners carried deep into the Persian heartland. On the day he spent in Tadmor, from her rooftop, Aliat witnessed magnificence, gallant horses, richly caparisoned camels, riders, whose helmets and mail coats, lances and shields turned sunlight into flame, cloaks like wind-blown rainbows, trumpet and drum, and deep-voiced chant. The streets surged, the oasis boiled with the conquerors, yet she noticed that the far greater number of them were lean and roughly clad. Likewise was their garrison here, and their officials lived simple lives, five times daily humbling themselves before God when the muezzin's call wailed across the sky. Nor were they bad rulers. They levied tribute, but it was not unbearable. They turned a few churches into mosques, but otherwise left Christians and Jews in the peace that they sternly enforced. The Qadi, their chief justice, held court beneath the arch at the east end of the colonnade, near the Agora, and even the lowliest could appeal directly to him. Their eruption had been too swift to damage trade much, and it soon began reviving. Aliat was not altogether surprised when Zabda said to her, in the tone that meant he would banish her to a rear room if she gave him any dispute, "I have reached a great decision. This household shall embrace Islam." Nonetheless, she stood a while quiescent amidst the shadows with which the single frugal lamp filled their bedchamber. When she spoke, it was slowly, and her eyes searched him. "This is indeed a matter of the first importance. Have they compelled you?" He shook his head. "No, no, they do not, except pagans, I am told." He formed his thin, brief smile. "They would rather most of us remain Christians, so we may own land, which believers may not, and pay tribute for it as well as the other taxes. My talks with the imam whom I approached have been difficult, but of course he may not refuse a sincere convert." "You'll gain many advantages." He reddened. "Do you call me a hypocrite?" "No, no, certainly not, my lord." Zabdus turned mild. "I understand. To you this is a terrible shock, you who have been raised to worship Christ. Think, though. The prophet never denied that Jesus was also a prophet. He was simply not the last one, the one to whom God revealed the full truth. Islam sweeps away the superstition about countless saints, the priests who come between a man and his God, the witless commandments and restrictions. We have but to acknowledge that there is one God, and Muhammad is his prophet. We have but to live righteous lives." He lifted a forefinger. "Think, could the Arabs have borne everything before them as they have done, as they are doing and shall do? Were theirs not the cause that is blessed, the faith that is true? I am bringing us to the truth, Aliat." He squinted, peering. "You welcome the truth, do you not? It cannot harm you, can it?" Recklessly she cast across the space between them. "I hear a man who becomes a Muslim must suffer what Jewish boys do." "It will not disable me," he snapped, curbing temper again. "I do not expect a woman to understand these deep things. Only trust in me." She swallowed, willed ease upon herself, moved toward him. "I do, my lord, I do," she murmured. Maybe she could cause him to beget a third child on her, and maybe that one would survive to give meaning back to her life. He seldom took her to him, mostly when she made herself coax him in that same hope. It was almost as if, more and more, he feared her. As for the change of religion, that mattered less than he supposed. What had the saints done to help throughout the endless years? 8. She had not foreknown what the change meant. Islam burst upon Syria too suddenly. Zabda studied it before he made his move. Only when the thing was done did she learn. The Prophet had laid upon women of the faith the ancient usages of Arabia. In public they must wear the yashmak, the heavy veil hiding everything but the eyes, and likewise at home in the presence of any man but father, brother, husband, or son. Unchastity was punished by death. Quarters for men and women were separate, like an invisible wall built through the house, to whose door its master had the single key. Submission of wife to husband was not bounded by law and custom as it was among Christians and Jews. While a marriage lasted, it was total. His the right to mutilate or kill the disobedient. Aside from such tasks as marketing, she had nothing to do with the outside world. He, his children by her, and his dwelling were to be her universe. For her there was no church, and whatever paradise she might hope for would not be his. So Zabdus explained, piecemeal as occasion arose. Aliat was not sure the law was quite that one-sided. She was entirely sure that in most families practice softened it. But be that as it may, she was a prisoner. She was even denied the solace of wine. That might be just as well, she decided, once the first rage had faded. She had been resorting to it much oftener than was wise. Oddly, however, as the Muslim months passed, she found herself less alone than hitherto. Thrust together, the females of the household, not only she and the slaves, but the wives and girl-children of two of Zabda's sons who had joined him in Tadmor, at first quarreled viciously, then began to confide in each other. Her position and her freedom from aging had set her apart. Those who now saw her sharing their helplessness discovered they could overlook these things, and if they told her their troubles, she would do what little she could to aid them. For her part, she learned bit by bit that she was not utterly isolated. In some ways, she touched more of the city than she had done since Barikai's death. She might be confined, but lesser females must needs go out on various errands, and they had kinfolk with whom they gossiped at every opportunity, and nobody cared to be strict with the humble, nor stop to think that they too possessed sharp ears, open eyes, and inquiring minds. As the touch of a fly quivers through the web to the spider that sits at its middle, so did flickers of information reach Aliat. She was not present when Zabda sought the Qadi soon after his conversion, but in view of what was overheard and passed on, and what happened later, eventually she believed she could reconstruct it almost as well as if she had been invisibly listening. Normally, the Qadi heard pleas in the open. Everybody was free to come. She could have done so had she had any real plaint. She thought of it, and concluded drearily that she did not. Zabdus was never abusive. He provided adequately. If he no longer came to her bed, what should a woman close to her 90th year expect, whether or not she had again borne him a child, and this one did keep on living? The very thought was obscene. He asked for a private audience, and the Qadi granted it. The two sat in the house of Mithal ibn Dirdar and sipped chilled pomegranate juice while they talked. Neither paid heed to the eunuch who waited on them, but he had acquaintances outside who, in their turn, knew people. "Yes, of course you may divorce your wife," Mithal said. "It is easily done. However, under the law she retains all property that was hers, and I gather she brought a fair amount to this marriage. In every event, you must see to it that she does not become destitute or lack for protection." He bridged his fingers. "Moreover, do you wish to offend her kinfolk?" "Iran's good will is worth little these days," Zabdus clipped. "His business fares poorly. Aliat's other children, by her first marriage, scarcely know her any more. But, the requirements you describe, those could prove awkward." Mithal regarded him closely. "Why do you wish to put this woman from you? In what is she at fault? Proud, resentful, sullen?" "No," said Zabdus beneath that gaze. "I cannot in honesty call her contumacious." "Has she not given you a child?" A girl. The two before. They soon died. The girl is small and sickly. That is shabby ground for blame, my friend. Old seed gives thin fruit.
Zobdis chose to misunderstand.
Old, yes, by the prophet. I have inquired. I should have done so at the first, but... Sir, she nears the 100-year mark.
The Cadi's lips formed a soundless whistle.
And yet, one hears rumors. Is she not yet fair? And you tell me she remains healthy and fertile.
Zobdis leaned forward. Sunlight fell through the grill over a window to dapple his balding head. Behind sparse whiskers, the wattles under his jaw wobbled as he cried in a high-pitched, cracking voice, "It's unnatural! Lately she lost a tooth or two, and I believed at last. But new ones are growing out, as if she were a child of 6 or 7. She must be a witch, or an ifrit, a demon, a... That's what I beg for. That's what I ask for, an investigation, an assurance I can cast her out and not have to fear her vengeance. Help me!" Michal raised a palm.
"Hold, hold!"
His words flowed soft. "Be calm. Truly we have a marvel here. Yet all things are possible to God the Omnipotent. She has not been impious or sinful in any way, has she? You may have done right to keep her as secluded as you could, since you, her husband, have had this terror brewing within you. If the tale went abroad and spread panic, she might have been set on in the streets. Beware of that." Severely. "Ancient patriarchs lived close to 1,000 years on earth. If God the Compassionate sees fit to let... Aliat, is that her name? Linger for close to 100, ageless. Who are we to question his will or divine his purpose?" Zobdis stared at his lap. What teeth remained to him gritted together.
"Nevertheless," he mumbled, "my counsel is that you keep her as long as she does no evil, for this is both justice for her and prudence for you. My decree, upholding the law, is that you offer her no harm when she has offered none, nor make accusations that are baseless."
Mitkal reached for his cup, sipped, smiled. "But true, if coupling with a crone strikes you as indecent, that is a matter of your choice. Have you considered taking a second wife? You are allowed 4, you know, besides concubines." In these latter years of his, Zobdis was quick to cool down from both his angers and his fears. He sat a moment silent, looking into a corner of the room. Then his mouth tilted upward, and he murmured, "I thank my lord for his wise and merciful judgment." 9. The day came when he summoned Aliat to his office. It was a chamber, bare and cramped. A window opened on the inner court, but was too high up to afford sight of water or flowers. A niche gaped white where once the image of a saint stood. At the far end, a dais held a table bestrewn with letters, records, and writing materials. Behind it, he sat on a bench. She entered. He laid aside a papyrus sheet, which crackled, and pointed downward. She went to knees and toes on the bare tiles before him. Silence stretched.
"Well?"
he snapped. She kept her eyes lowered.
"What is my lord's desire? What have you to say for yourself?"
"What must your handmaiden defend?"
"Mock me not!" he shouted. "I've had my fill of your insolence. Now you have struck my wife in the face. It is too much."
Aliat looked up, caught his glance, held fast.
"I thought Fujah would go whimpering to you," she said steadily. "What tale did she bear? Fetch her and let me hear."
His fist struck the desk.
"I will settle this. I am the master. I am being kind. I am giving you your chance to explain why you should escape a whipping."
She drew breath. This had been foreseeable since the thing happened. She had had a pair of hours wherein to marshal words. "My lord must know that his new bride and I are apt to quarrel." Stupid, weak-chinned, spiteful creature, forever seeking to squirm herself into the man's favor and shrill herself into sovereignty over the harem. Alas that this should be! It is wrong. That tasted foul, but had better be said. Today she gave me an intolerable insult. I smote her once, open-handedly, across the chops. She wailed and fled, to you, who have things of importance to deal with. She has often complained to me. You have been overbearing ever since she came into my house. I have demanded no more than the respect due your senior wife, my lord. I will not become a slave, a dog, a thing. What was this insult? Asked Zobdus. It was vile. Must I take it in my mouth? Describe it. She shrieked that I keep my looks and strength by means unspeakable in decent company. Are you certain? Women have flighty memories. I suppose if you haled her in and put the question, she would deny it. Not her first lie. Word against word. Zobdus sighed loudly. What is a man to believe? When shall he find peace to get on with his work? Women. I think men, too, would grow jangle-witted were they shut away forever with nothing to do that was worth the doing, said Aliat, for she felt she had little to lose. If I have left you undisturbed, it has been out of consideration for your age. And yours, my lord, she dared purr. He paled. The brown spots on his skin stood plain to see. For Jar does not find me wanting. Not quite every night of the month, Aliat thought, and in sudden surprising pity. He fears that his uneasiness about me would unman him, and likely that very fear would. But they were moving toward deadly ground. She drew back. I pray my lord's pardon. No doubt some of the blame does fall on me, his servant. I simply hope to explain to him why squabbles trouble his harem. If Forjah will show me courtesy, I will do likewise. Zobdus rubbed his chin and stared beyond her. She had a brief, eerie feeling that somehow this was a chance for which he had waited. At length he regarded her and said, his tone strained, Life was different for you in your young days. Old people find it hard to change. At the same time, this vigor you have kept makes it impossible for you to resign yourself. Am I right? She swallowed. My lord speaks truth, she answered, amazed that he showed any insight. And I have heard that you were helpful to your first husband in his business, he went on. She could only nod. Well, I have given you much thought, Aliat, he said faster. My duty under God is to provide for your welfare, which should include your spirits. If time has become empty for you, if our daughter is not enough, well, perhaps we can find something more. Her heart sprang, blood thundered in her ears. Again he looked past her. What I have in mind is irregular, he said, cautiously now. No violation of the law, understand, but it could cause gossip. I am willing to hazard this for your sake, but you must do your part. You must exercise the utmost discretion. For whatever my lord commands. It will be a beginning, a trial. If you acquit yourself well, who knows what may follow? But hark! He wagged his forefinger. In Emesa is a youth, a distant kinsman of mine who is eager to go into the business. His father will be pleased if I invite him here and train him. I lack time to teach him the ins and outs, the rules and customs and traditions peculiar to Tadmor, as well as the basic practicalities, especially where it comes to making shipments, to dealing with caravaneers. I could assign a man of mine to his instruction, but I can ill spare anyone. You, however, I suppose you remember. Of course, the utmost discretion is essential. Aliat prostrated herself. Trust me, my lord, she sobbed. 10. Fanur was tall, broad in the shoulders, slim in the waist. His beard was the merest overlay of silk across the smooth features, but a man's strength rested in the hands. His movements and his eyes were like a gazelle's. Though he was Christian, Zobdus received him cordially before sending him to find a bed among the other young men who served and learned here. A 12-month back, the merchant had bought a lesser building adjacent to his home. He set workers to erect walls and roof, joining the pair together, then knock out what separated them and make them one. Thus he would gain added offices, storerooms, and quarters for an expanded staff. His trade was burgeoning. Lately he had ordered a halt to the construction. He declared it was better to wait and see what effect the ongoing conquest of Persia would have on the traffic with India. The addition, therefore, stood unfurnished, unoccupied, dusty, and silent. When he led her into it, Aliat was astonished to find a room at the far end had been swept and outfitted. A plain but thick wool carpet softened the floor. Hangings flanked the second-story window. A table held a water carafe, cups, papyrus, ink, pens. Two stools waited nearby, and Bunur did. Though Aliat had been introduced to him earlier, her pulse quickened. He salaamed deeply. "Be at ease," said Zabdus, with unaccustomed cordiality. "At ease, my dears. If we are to be a little irregular, we may as well enjoy it." He took a turn around the room, talking. "For my wife to explain things to you, Bunur, and for you to ask of her, you need freedom. I am not the dry stick people take me for. I know that the folk ways, the subtleties of a city, cannot be entered in a ledger or parsed like a sentence. Stares and sniggers and the constraint you would feel, did you sit conferring in plain sight of every fool, those would bind your tongues, your minds. The task would become difficult, prolonged, perhaps impossible. And to be sure, I would be considered eccentric at best for setting you to it. Men might wonder if I was near my dotage. That would be bad for trade, oh, yes. Therefore this retreat. At such times as I deem right, when your services are not required elsewhere, Bunur, I will send word. You will leave the house and enter this section by its back door, on the lane behind. And I will give you a signal, Aliat. You will betake yourself directly here. In fact, sometimes you will come here to be alone. You have desire to help me. Very well, you may look over such reports and figures as I shall lend you, undisturbed, and offer me your opinions. This will be common knowledge. At other times, unbeknownst to anyone else, you will meet Bunur."
"But, sir—"
Red and white went in waves over the boyish face. "The lady and I, and nobody else? Surely a maidservant, a eunuch, or—" Zabdus shook his head. "The protestation does you honor," he replied. "However, a watcher would defeat my whole purpose, which is to give you a true feel of conditions in Tadmor while avoiding derision and insinuations." He looked from one to the other of them. "I never doubt I can trust my kinsman and my first wife." With a flick of a smile, "She is, after all, aged beyond the usual span of life."
"What?"
Bunur exclaimed. "Master, you jest. The veil, the gown, they cannot hide—"
"It is true," said Zabdus, a low sibilation. "You shall hear of it from her, along with things less curious." 11. A day approached sunset.
"Well," said Aliat, "best we stop. I have duties still before me."
"And I. And I should think upon what you have revealed to me this time."
Bunur's voice dragged. Neither of them rose from the stools on which they sat facing. Abruptly he colored, dropped his gaze, and blurted, "My lady has a wonderful intelligence." It felt like a caress. "No, no," she protested. "In a long life, even a stupid person learns a few things." She saw him break down a barrier so that he could meet her eyes. "Hard to believe you are old."
"I carry my years well."
How often had she said it precisely thus? How mechanical it had become.
"All you have seen," reckless impulse, "the change of faith, that you were forced away from Christ."
"I have no regrets, do you not? If only for the freedom you have lost, the freedom your friends have lost, the simple freedom to look upon you." For an instant she was about to hush him. Nothing closed off the doorway but a bead curtain. However, such a thing muffled sound somewhat, and deserted corridors and rooms stretched between it and the inhabited part. and he had spoken softly, deep in his throat, while tears glimmered on his lashes. "Who cares to see a hag?" she fended, and knew she was teasing. "You are not! You shouldn't have to cower behind that veil. I've noticed when you forgot to stoop and shamble. You have watched me closely, it seems." She fought at dizziness. "I cannot help myself," he confessed miserably. "You are too curious." As if a different creature used her tongue, her hands. "Best we quench that. Behold." She drew the yashmak aside. He gasped. She dropped it back and stood up. "Are you satisfied? Keep silence, or we shall have to end these meetings. My lord would mislike that." She left him. Her daughter met her in the harem. "Mama, where have you been? Gudne won't let me play with the lion doll." Ariad groped after patience. She ought to love this child, but Theria was whimpery and sick half the time, and resembled her father. 12. Sometimes the sameness of the days broke when Zobdus gave Aliat materials to study and report on. In the room that was apart, she tried to grasp what she read, but it slipped and wriggled about like a handful of worms. Twice she met there with Banur. The second time she took off her veil at the outset, and she had dressed in a gown of light material. "The weather is blazing hot," she told him, "and I am only an old granny, no, great-grandmother." They accomplished little. Silences kept falling between them. More days flowed sluggishly together. She lost count of them. What difference did their number make? Each was just like the last, save for bickerings and nuisances, and at night, dreams. Did Satan brew certain of those for her? If so, she owed him thanks. Then Zobda summoned her to his office. "Your counsel has gone worthless," he said peevishly. "Does your dotage come upon you at last?" She bit back rage. "I am sorry, my lord, if no thoughts have occurred to me of late. I will try to do better. What's the use? No use in you any more. For Jah now, for Jah warms my bed, and surely soon she'll be fruitful." Zobdus waved a hand in dismissal. "Well, be off. Go wait for Banur. I'll send him. Perhaps at least you can persuade him to mend those wool-gathering ways he's taken on. By all the saints, by the beard of the prophet, I regret my promises to both of you." Ariat stalked through the empty part of the house with fists clenched. In the room of meetings she prowled back and forth, back and forth. It was a cage. She halted at the window and stared out through the grill. From there she could look over the walls around the ancient temple of Bel. Its limestone seemed bleached under a furious sun. The bronze capitals of the portico columns blazed. Heat shimmer made the reliefs on the cella waver. Long had it stood unused, empty, like herself. Now it was being refurbished. She had heard at fourth or fifth hand that the Arabs planned to make a fortress of it. But were those powers entirely dead? Bel of the storm, Jarhabal of the sun, Aglabal of the moon, Ashtoreth of begettings and births, terrible in beauty, she who descended into hell to win back her lover. Unseen, they strode across the earth. Unheard, they shouted throughout heaven. The sea that Aliat had never known thundered behind her breasts. A footstep, a click of beads. She whirled about. Banur halted. Sweat sheened on him. She caught the smell of it, filling the heat and silence. Man's smell. She was wet with her own. The dress clung to her. She unfastened her veil and cast it to the floor. "My lady," he choked. "Oh, my lady." She advanced. Her hips swung as if of themselves. Breath loudened. "What would you with me, Banur?" His gazelle eyes fled right and left, trapped. He backed off a step. He raised his hands against her. "No," he begged. "No what?" she laughed. She stopped before him, and he must needs meet her look. We've things to do, you and I. If he is wise, he will agree. He will sit down and begin asking about the best way to bargain with a caravaneer. I will not let him be wise. 13. I have business in Tripolis, Zabda said. It may keep me several weeks. I shall go with Nebozabad, who leaves a few days hence. Aliat was glad she had left her veil on after reaching his office. Does my lord wish to say what business it is? No sense in that. You've grown barren of advice, as of everything else. I am informing you privately, so that I can state what should be obvious, that in my absence you are to abide in the harem and occupy yourself with the wife's ordinary duties.
Of course, my lord. She and Vanur had thus far had two afternoons together. 14. Thirius stirred.
Mama.
Aliat pushed Fury down. Hush, darling, she breathed. Go to sleep. And she must wait while the child tossed and whined until finally the bed was quiet. Finally. Her feet remembered the way through the dark. She clutched her nightgown to her lest it brush against something. The thought flitted, like this do the unrestful dead steal from their graves. But it was to life that she was going. Already the juices of it ran hot. Her nostrils drank the cedary odor of her desire. Nobody else woke, and there was no guard on as small, as drab a harem as this. Her fingers touched walls, guiding her until she reached the last dear corridor. No, do not run. Make no needless sound. The beads in the doorway snaked around her. The window framed stars. A breeze from the cooling desert drifted through it. Her pulse racketed. She pulled off the gown and tossed it aside. He came. Her toes gripped the carpet. Aliat, Aliat. The rough whisper echoed in her head. Vanur stumbled, knocked a stool over, panted. She gurgled laughter and slipped to him. I knew you would come, beloved, she sang. His arms enclosed her. She clawed herself tight to him, her tongue thrust between his lips. He bore her down. They were on the carpet. The thought flashed that she must take care it showed no stains. He groaned, and she reached after him. Lantern light glared. Behold! Zabdus cackled. Vanur rolled off Aliat. Both sat up, crouched back, crawled to their feet. The lantern swung in Zabdus' hand. It sent huge, misshapen shadows a dance over the walls. She saw him in fragments. Eyeballs, nose, wet snags of teeth, wrinkles, hatred. Right and left of him were his two sons. They bore swords. The steel gleamed. Boys, seize them! Zabda shouted. Vanur reeled. He lifted his hands like a beggar. No, master, my lord, no! It tumbled through Aliat. Zabdus had planned this from the first. He had no passage arranged with a caravan. These three waited in another room, their light muffled, for that which he knew would happen. Now he would be rid of her, and keep her property, and believe that even an ifrit, or whatever inhuman thing she might be, would not return from the punishment for adultery. Once she would have welcomed an ending, but the weariness of the years was burned out of her. Vanur, fight! She screamed. They'll tie us in a sack and the people will stone us to death. She laid her hands on his back and shoved him forward. Are you a man? Save us! He howled and leaped. A man swung sword. Unpracticed, he missed. Vanur caught that arm with one hand. His fist crunched into the nose behind. The second brother edged around awkwardly, afraid of hitting the wrong body. The struggle lurched past Aliat. It left a smear of blood on her. She bounced clear. Zabdus blocked the doorway. She snatched the lantern from the old man's feeble grasp and dashed it to the floor. Oil flared in yellow flame. He staggered aside. She heard him shriek as the fire licked his ankle. She fled past the beads, down hall and stairway, out the rear door, from the lane into ghost-gray streets between blank walls. The Philippian gates stayed open after dark when a caravan was making ready. If she took care, if she moved slowly and kept to the shadows, its sentries might not see her.
Oh, Bonheur! But she had no breath or tears to spare for him, not yet, not if she wanted to live. 15. Those in the caravan who glanced behind them saw the towers of Tadmor catch the first sungleam. Then they were up the valley and out on the steppe. Ahead of them the sky also brightened until the last stars faded away. Signs of man were sparse on that day's travel. After Nebozabad left the Roman road on a short cut across the desert, there was nothing but a trail worn by the generations before him who had fared likewise. He called halt for the night at a muddy pool where the horses could drink. Men contented themselves with what they carried along in skins, camels with what scrawny shrubs were to be found. The master strode through the bustle and hubbub to a certain driver. "I will take that bale now, Hatim," he said. The other grinned. Like most in this trade, he considered smuggling to be a part of it, and never asked unnecessary questions. The bale was actually a long bundle tied together with rope, which had been nestled into the load on the camel. Nebozabad's slave carried it back into the master's tent, laid it down, salaamed, and went to squat outside, forbidding intruders. Nebozabad knelt, undid the knots, unrolled the cloth. Aliat crept forth. Sweat plastered her hair and the jalaba he had lent to the curves of her. The countenance was hollow-eyed, the lips cracked. Yet once he had given her water and a bite of food, she recovered with eerie quickness, well-nigh minute by minute as he watched. "Speak low," he warned. "How have you fared?" "It was hot and dry and gut-wrenching bumpy," she answered in a voice husky more than hoarse. "But I shall forever thank you. Did a search party come?" He nodded. "Soon after we left, a few Arabian soldiers rousted out, after Zabdus gained himself ill will by waking the Cadi, I gather. They were sleepy and uninterested. We need not have hidden you so well." She sighed where she sat, knees drawn up, ran fingers through her matted tresses, gave him a smile that shone and lingered in the lamp-lit dusk. "You cared, dear friend." Cross-legged before her, he scowled. "Reckless was I. It might cost me my head, and I've my family to think of." She reached to stroke fingers across his wrist. "Rather would I die than bring harm on you. Give me a water-skin and a little bread, and I will strike off across the desert." "No, no," he exclaimed. "That would be a slower death, unless the nomads found you, which would be worse. No, I can take you along. We'll swaddle you well in garments too large, keep you offside and unspeaking. I'll say you're a boy, kin to me, who's requested a ride to Tripolis." He grinned sourly. "Those who doubt the kin part of that will snicker behind my back. Well, let them. My tent is yours to share while the journey lasts. God will reward you where I cannot. Barikai in paradise will intercede for your soul." Nebozabad shrugged. "I wonder how much good that will do when it's the escape of a confessed adulteress I'm aiding." Her mouth trembled. A tear ran down the sweat and grime dried on her cheeks. "It's right, though," he said in haste. "You told me what cruelties drove you from your wits." She caught his nearer hand in both hers and clung. He cleared his throat. "Yet you must understand, Aliat, I can do no more than this. In Tripolis I must leave you, with what few coins I can spare, and thereafter you are alone. Should I be charged with having helped you, I will deny all. And I will deny I saw you, but fear not. I'll vanish from sight. Whither? How shall you live, forsaken?" "I will. I have already seen 90 years. Look, have they left any mark on me?" He stared. "They have not," he mumbled. "You are strange, strange. Nonetheless, simply a woman. Nebozabad, I can do somewhat to repay a morsel of your kindness. The only things I have to offer are memories, but those you can bring home with you." He sat motionless. She drew closer. "It is my wish," she whispered. "They will be my memories, too." 16. And gladsome they are, she thought, when afterward he lay sleeping. I could almost envy his wife. Until he grew old, and she did. Unless first a sickness took one or the other off. Aliette had never in her life been ill. Her flesh had forgotten the abuse of the day and the night that were past. A pleasant languor pervaded it. But if, perchance, he should awaken, she would instantly arouse to eagerness. She smiled in the dark. Allow the man his rest. She would like to go out and walk about a while under the moon and the high desert stars. No, too risky. Wait, wait. She had learned how. Pain twinged. Poor Banur. Poor Thyria. But if ever she let herself weep for any of the short-lived, there would be no end of weeping. Poor Tadmor. But a new city lay ahead, and beyond it, all the world and time. A woman who was ageless had one way, if none else, to live onward in freedom. Chapter 5. No man shuns his doom. It is told in the saga of Olaf Tryggvason how Nornagest came to him when he was at Nidaros and abode some while in the king's hall, for many and wonderful were the tales that Gest bore. Evening after lengthening evening, as the year drew toward winter, men sat by the fires and hearkened. Tales they heard from lifetimes agone and the far ends of the world. Often he gave them staves as well, for he was a skald, and was apt to strum a harp underneath the words, in English wise. There were those who muttered he must be a liar, asking how any man could have fared so widely or been so old. But King Olaf bade these be still, and himself listened keenly. "I was living on a farm in the uplands," Gest had said to him. "Now my last child yonder has died, and again I am weary of my dwelling. Wearier than ever, Lord. Word of you reached me, and I have come to see whether it is true." "What you have heard that is good is true," answered the priest Conor. "By God's grace he is bringing a new day to Norway." "But your day first broke very long ago, Gest, did it not?" murmured Olaf. "We have heard of you again and again. Everyone has, though none but your neighbors in the mountains have seen you for many years, and I supposed you must be dead." When he looked at the newcomer, he saw a man, tall and lean, straight in the back, gray of hair and beard, but with few lines across the strong bones of his face. "You are not really aged, after all." Gest sighed. "I am older than I seem, Lord." "Gest of the Norns, a strange and heathenish nickname, that," said the king slowly. "How did you come by it?"
"You may not want to hear." And Gest turned the talk elsewhere. Right well did he understand the craft of doing so. Over and over Olaf urged him to take baptism and be saved, yet the king did not make threats or order death, as he did with most who were stubborn about this. Gest's tales were so gripping that he wanted to keep the wanderer here. Conor pressed harder, seeking Gest out almost daily. The priest was eager in the holy work. He had come with Olaf when the latter sailed from Dublin to Norway, overthrew Hakon Jarl, and won the land for himself. Now the king was calling in missionaries from England and Germany as well as Ireland, and maybe Conar felt a bit left out. Gest gave him grave heed and soft answers. "I am no stranger to your Christ," Gest said. "I have met him often, or at least his worshippers. Nor am I plighted to Odin and Thor." His smile was rueful. "I have known too many different gods." "But this is the true and only God," Conor replied. "Hang not back, or you will be lost. In just a few years a full thousand will have passed since his birth among men. Belike he will come back then, end the world, and raise the dead for judgment." Gest stared afar. "It would be good to believe I can meet my dead anew," he whispered. And he let Conor talk on. At eventide, however, after meat, when the trestle tables had been taken from the hall and women carried the drinking horns forth, he had other things to talk about, yarns to spin, verses to chant, questions to meet. Once a couple of guardsmen happened to speak of the great battle of Bravellir. My forebear Grani from Brundal was among the Icelanders who fought the King Sigurd Ring, one boasted. He cut his way close enough to see King Harald Wartooth fall. Starkad himself had not strength to save the Danes that day. Guest stirred. Forgive me, he said. There were no Icelanders at Bravellir. Norsemen had not yet found that island. The warrior bristled. Have you never heard the lay that Starkad made? He flung back. It names all the worthies who came to the fray on either side. Guest shook his head. I have heard, and I do not call you a liar, Eivin. You passed on what you were told, but Starkad never made any such lay. Another skald did, lifetimes afterward, and put it in his mouth. Bravellir was bloodied. He sat a few heartbeats, thinking, while the fires in the trenches guttered and crackled. Was it 300 years ago? I have lost track. Do you mean Starkad was not there, and you were? Jibed the guardsman. Oh, he was, said Guest, though he was not much like the stories men tell of him now, nor lamed and half-blind with age when at last he went to his death. Stillness fell anew. King Olaf peered through shifting shadows at the speaker before he asked low, Did you then know him? Guest nodded. I did. Indeed, it was right after Bravellir that we met. 1. His staff was a spear, for no man traveled unarmed in the north, but over the small pack on his back hung a harp in its case, and he offered harm to none. When at nightfall he found a homestead, he slept there, repaying hospitality with songs and tales and news from outside. Otherwise he rolled up in his cloak, and by dawnlight drank from a spring or brook, and ate of whatever bread and cheese his latest host had given him. Thus had he fared through most of his years, from end to end of the world. This day was cool beneath a wan sky, where clouds were scant and the sun swung southward. The woods that decked the hills of Gautland stood hazed and hushed. Birches had begun to turn yellow, and the green of oak and beech was less bright than erstwhile. Firs lifted darkling among them. Ripe currants glowed in the shade. Smells of earth and damp filled every breath. Guest saw it all, widely, from a ridge he had climbed. Below him the land rolled off to an unclear edge of sight. Mostly it was tree-clad, but meadows and ploughed fields broke it here and there. He spied 2 houses and their outbuildings. Distance dwindled. Smoke rose straight upward from the roofs. Close by a stream glistened on its way to a lake that shone in the offing. He had come far enough from the battlefield that the wreckage and the dead strewn across it were blurred together in his eyes. Carrion birds swarmed aloft and about and back down, a whirling blackness, but also gone tiny for him. He could barely hear their cries. Sometimes a howl of a wolf lifted to hang above the hills for what seemed a long while before dying away in echoes. Living men had withdrawn, bound home. They took wounded kindred and friends along, but could merely throw a little earth over such of the fallen as they knew. A band of them whom Guest had come upon this morning did tell him that King Sigurd had borne off the body of his foe King Harald to give it a barrow and grave goods at Uppsala for the sake of his own honor. Guest leaned on his spear, shook his head, and smiled sadly. How often had he beheld the like of this after young men stormed forth to cast their lives from them? He did not know. He had lost the number somewhere in the waste of the centuries, or else he had never had the heart to try keeping count. He was not sure of which any more. Yet, as always, he felt the need to say a farewell, the only thing he or anyone else could now give the young men. It was no scaldic dropper that came to his lips. The words were northern, so that the dead would understand if they could hear, but he lacked all wish to praise bravery and recall mighty deeds. The verse form that he chose was from a country thousands of miles toward the sunrise. There a short, slanty-eyed folk knew much and fashioned things of wondrous beauty, though there, too, the sword ranged free. The summer fading, chill shall slash the leaves bloody, and the geese trek where? Already this ground went red while the wind called souls away. A brief spell more Guest lingered, then turned and departed. Those Danes he met earlier had seen the one whom he sought leave soon after half a dozen Swedes did, and follow them eastward. Thereupon Guest had gone to Bravelier and cast about until his woodsman's eye lighted on what he thought must be the tracks. He had better hurry. Nonetheless, he kept to his everyday stride. It looked lazy, but in the course of a day it left as much behind it as a horse might, or more, and it let him stay aware of everything around him. He was on a game trail. The kings had set Bravelier as their meeting place because it was a broad meadow through which a road ran north and south, about halfway between Harald in Scania and Sigurd in Sweden. However, the land round about was thinly settled. The six going this way must be headed for the Baltic shore, where lay the ship or ships that had brought them. That they were so few bespoke how terrible the battle had been. It would be remembered, sung about, made even larger in the minds of men for hundreds of years to come, and those who ploughed yonder fields would moulder forgotten. Guest's shoes scuffed softly on soil. Branches were a roof overhead, through which sunbeams fell to make spatters of light on the shadowy hallway before him. A squirrel ran like a flame up a tree. Somewhere a dove moaned. Brush rustled on the left. A great dim shape slipped off. An elk. Guest let his soul drift into the sweet-smelling reaches. Meanwhile, though, he kept reading the traces. That was easy. Footprints, broken twigs, torn spider-webs, marks on mossy logs where men had sat down to rest. They were no hunters by trade, as he had been through much of his life, nor was the one who followed them, never stopping, closing the gap between. Those feet were huge. Time passed. The sunbeams lowered, lengthened, took on a golden hue. A bit of cold crept into the air. Suddenly Guest halted. He leaned forward, head cocked, listening. Faintly to him came a noise he thought he knew. He quickened his pace to a lope. Muffled at first by leaves, the sound swelled fast, clang and clatter, shouts, soon crackling, snapping, and harsh breath. Guest brought his spear to the ready and glided on as quietly as might be. A slain man sprawled across the trail. He had fallen into a bush that snagged the upper half of him. Blood dripped from its stems and pooled below, screamingly bright. A blow had cloven him from the left shoulder through the breastbone. Pieces of rib and lung poked out of him. Fair hair clung sweat-matted to cheeks whereon no beard grew, just the down of a boy. He stared and gaped emptily. Guest drew aside and found himself treading on another body. Close by, brush churned with combat. He glimpsed men, iron, blood, and more blood. Weapon banged on weapon, scraped across helmets, thudded against wooden shields. Another fighter toppled. A thigh spouted red. He threshed about and shrieked. It was the kind of noise a human throat ought not to make. A fourth warrior dropped and lay sodden in a patch of nettles. The head was nearly off him. Guest got behind a young fir. It screened him, and he could see between its limbs. Two were left of the band that the newcomer had overtaken and attacked. Like their mates, they wore only sarks, coats, breeks. If any owned mail, he had not thought to put it on until too late. Both these did have kettle hats. One carried sword and shield, one an axe. Their lone foe was fully outfitted in knee-length burnie, conical helmet with nose guard, an iron-rimmed shield in his left grip, and a sword of uncommon size in his right. He was more than big, overtopping Guest's goodly height by a head, shoulders as wide as a door-frame, arms and legs like oak boughs. An unkempt black beard reached to his chest. The pair had recovered from the shock of his onslaught. They worked together, barking words to and fro. The swordsman went straight at the giant. Blades clashed, a gleam when they rose into a sunbeam, a blur as they hissed downward or sideways. The Swede caught a blow on his shield that made him lurch, but stood fast and struck back. The axemen circled behind their enemy. The huge man must have known it. Blindingly fast, he spun on his heel and plunged at the axeman, offside, so that the stroke missed him by inches. His blade whipped. The axeman staggered, dropped his weapon, stared at a right forearm laid open and bone-shattered. The giant leaped on past him. There was a grassy patch between him and the other swordsman. At its end he turned and burst into a run at that fellow. Shields boomed together, with weight and speed behind his. Overborne, the Swede went on his back. Somehow he kept hold of his sword and got his shield up. The giant sprang high and landed on him. Shield was driven against ribs. Guest thought he heard them crack. Breath whooped out. The giant straddled the writhing body and made his kill in two strokes. He glared around. The wounded axeman was in flight, blundering off among the boles. The winner dashed after and cut him down. The shrieks of the thigh-slashed man ebbed off to cawing, to rattling, to silence. Laughter boomed from a cavern of a breast. The huge man rammed his blade thrice into the earth, wiped it clean on the shirt of a fallen, and sheathed it. His breathing eased. He doffed helmet and coif, dropped them, swept a hairy hand over the sweat that runneled off his brow. Guest came out from behind the fir. The giant snatched at his hilt. Guest leaned spear in the crotch of a tree and spread his palms. "I am peaceful," he said. The warrior stayed taut. "But are you alone?" he asked. His voice was like heavy surf on a strand of stones. Guest looked into the rugged face, the small ice-blue eyes, and nodded. "I am. Besides, after what I have just seen, I would not think Starkad need be wary of anyone or anything." The warrior grinned. "Ah, you know me. But we have not met ere now. Everybody in the north has heard of Starkad the Strong, and I have been in search of you." "You have?" Surprise turned into a glower. "Then it was a Nithing's trick to stand aside and give me no help." "You had no need," said Guest in his mildest tone. "Also, the battle went so fast. Never have I seen such weapon-wielding." "Please," Starkad spoke friendlier. "Who are you that seek me?" "I have borne many names. In the north it has oftenest been Guest." "What would you of me?" "That is a long tale. May I first ask why you hounded these men down and slew them?" Starkad's gaze went elsewhere, toward the sun, whose light shot in yellow beams between trees turning dark against heaven. His lips moved. After a bit he nodded, met Guest's look again, and said, "Here shall wolves not hunger. Harald fed the ravens. Honor won we. Only Odin overcame us. Ale I lack, but offer all these foes to Harald. Never was he niggard. Now I've shown I'm thankful." So it was true what they said, Guest thought. As well as being the foremost of warriors, Starkad had some gift as a scald. What else might he be? "I see," Guest acknowledged slowly. "You fought for Harald and wished to avenge your lord after he fell, though the war be done with." Starkad nodded. "I hope I have gladdened his ghost. Still more do I hope I have gladdened his forebear, King Frodi, who was the best of lords and never stinted me of gold or weapons, or other fine things." A tingle went through Guest, a chill along his backbone. "Was that Frodi Fridleifsson in Denmark? They say Starkad was of his household, but he died lifetimes ago." "I am older than I seem," answered Starkad with renewed roughness. He shook himself. "After this day's work, thirst is a fire in me. Would you know where there is water? I know how to find water if you will come with me," Guest told him. "But what of these dead men?" Starkad shrugged. "I am no scald crow to pick them clean. Leave them for the ants." Flies buzzed around blind eyes, parched tongues, clotting blood. Stenches hung heavy. Guest had grown used to such sights, but he was ever happy to lay them behind him, and tried not to dwell on thoughts of widows, children, mothers. The lives he had shared were short at best, the merest blink of years, and afterward, for most, a span hardly longer before they were wholly forgotten by all but him. He took his spear and led the way down the trail. "Will you be returning to Denmark?" he asked. "I think not," rumbled Starkad at his back. Sigurd will make sure the next king in Hydra is beholden to him, and that the underkings are at odds with each other. Chances for a fighting man. But I'd mislike watching the realm fall asunder that Frodi built and Harald Wartooth rebuilt. Guest sighed. From what I have heard, the seed of something great died at Bravellir. What will you do? Take ships that I own, gather crews for them, and go in Viking, eastward to Wendland and Gardhariki, I think. Is that a harp you bear above your pack? Guest nodded. I've put my hand to sundry kinds of work, but mainly I am a scald. Then come with me. When we reach a lord's hall, make a drapa about what I wrought this day. I'll reward you well. We must talk about that. Silence fell between them. After a while, Guest saw the signs he had been awaiting, and took a side trail. It opened on a glade starred with clover. A spring bubbled up at the middle. Water trickled off through the grass to lose itself under the trees. They made a wall around, dark beneath, still golden green on top where the last sunbeams touched them. The eastern sky was violet blue. A flight of rooks winged homeward. Starkad cast himself belly down and drank with mighty slurps. When at length he raised his dripping beard, he saw a guest busy. The wanderer had lain down his cloak, opened his pack, spread things out. Now he gathered deadwood below the trees and bushes that surrounded the glade. "What are you doing?" Starkad asked. "Making ready for night," Guest told him. "Does nobody dwell nearby? A swineherd's hut would do." "I know not, and belike darkness would overrun us while we searched. Besides, here is better rest than on a dirt floor breathing smoke and farts." "Oh, I've slept under the stars often enough, and gone hungry, too. I see you've a little food with you. Will you share?" Guest gave the warrior a close look. "You'd not simply take it from me?" "No, no, you are neither foeman nor quite a stranger." Starkad laughed. "Nor a woman. Too bad." Guest smiled. "We'll have what there is, though it's not much for a man your size. I'll set snares. By morning, with luck, we'll have voles to cook, or even a squirrel or hedgehog." He paused. "Would you like to help me? If you'll work as I show you, we can make ourselves snug before nightfall." Starkad rose. "Do you think me a coal-biter? Of course I'll take a hand. Are you a Finn, or have you dwelt among Finns to know these woods-runners' tricks?" "No, I was born in Denmark, like you, a long time ago. But I learned the hunter's craft in my boyhood." Guest found, unsurprised, that he must pick his words with care when giving orders. Starkad's haughtiness was like a flare. Once he roared, "Am I a thrall?" and half drew blade. He resheathed it, smacked fist into palm, and did as he was bidden. For that moment, pain had twisted his face. Daylight drained from the west. More and more stars glittered forth. When dusk had seeped upward to fill the glade, the men had their camp ready. A brushwood shelter, bracken and boughs heaped within, would allow rest free of dew, night mists, and rain if any fell. Turfs piled outside its mouth cast back into it the warmth of a fire that Guest had kindled with a drill. Besides nuts and berries, he had found pine cones, sedges, and roots to eke out the bread and cheese. After he had roasted them in the ways that were needful, he and Starkad would bed down fairly full. He hunkered at the fire with his knife whittling a green stick into part of a cooking tool. It was a fire more low than the warrior would have built, softly sputtering, its slight smoke savory of resin. Though air cooled fast at this season, Starkad learned he could stay comfortable by sitting close. The red and yellow flames cast wavery light over Guest's cheekbones and nose. It glinted from his eyes and made shadows in the gray beard. "These are good skills you own," Starkad said. "Indeed you shall fare with me." "We will talk of that," Guest answered, watching his work. "Why, you told me you were in search of me." "Yes, I was." Guest drew breath. "Long and long had I been away, until at last memories of the north overwhelmed me, and I must come back to see if the aspen still quivered in the light nights of midsummer. He did not speak of a woman who died after he and she fared 30 years together over the vast plains of the East with her herder tribesfolk. I had lost hope in my quest. I had stopped seeking, until as I walked through the woods and over the heaths of Jutland and the old tongue reawakened in me, not too much changed since I left. I began to hear about Starkad. Him I must meet. I followed word of him to Hlidr, where they said he had gone across the Sound to join King Harald, and thence onward to war. I followed that trail to Bravellir, and reached it at sunset when the day's slaughter had ended. In the morning I found men who had seen him go from it, and I took the way they pointed. And here we are, Starkad. The huge man shifted about. What would you of me? He growled uneasily. First I would ask for the tale of your life. Some of the stories I heard were wild. You're a news-greedy one. I have sought knowledge throughout the world. How shall a storyteller repay a knight's lodging or a scold make staves for chieftains, unless he have something word-worthy behind his teeth? Starkad had unbuckled his sword, but dropped hand to knife. Is this the beginning of witchcraft? Uncanny are you, guest? The wanderer locked gaze with the warrior and answered, I swear to cast no spell. What I am after is more strange than that. Starkad quelled a shiver. As if charging at fear to trample it underfoot, he said in a rush, What I have done is well known, though belike no man save me knows all of it. But sooth it is, wild and sometimes ugly tales have mushroomed over the years. I am not of Jotun birth. That's old wives' chatter. My father was a yeoman in the north of Zealand. My mother came of honest fisherfolk, and they had other children who grew up, lived like anybody else, grew old, and were laid in how, those that battle or sickness or the sea had spared, also like anybody else. How long have they lain in the earth? Guest asked softly. Starkad ignored the question. I was big and strong, as you see. From childhood I lacked wish to muck and plough the fields or haul nets full of stinking fish. 12 years old I went off in Viking. Some neighborhood men had a ship in common. They met with other ships and harried a while along the Norse shores. When they went back for hay harvest, I stayed behind. I sought out a skipper who was going to stay the winter, and thereafter my fame waxed fast. Shall I tell you of battles, reavings, burnings, feasts, hunger, cold, shipmates, women, offerings to the gods, strife against storm, and bad luck when the gods grew angry with us, kings we served and kings we overthrew? The years lie jumbled and awash in me like flotsam on a skerry. Frodi, king at Hlidra, took me in after I suffered a shipwreck. He made me the head of his household troops, and I made him the greatest of lords in his day. But his son Ingjald proved a weakling, sluggard, glutton. I upbraided him and quit the land in disgust. Yet from time to time I have been back and wielded blade for worthier men of the Scholding House. Harald was the best of them. He became first among kings through all of Denmark and Gautland, and well into Sweden. But now Harald is fallen, and his work broken, and I am alone again. He cleared his throat and spat. That may have been his way of not weeping. They told me Harald was aged, Guest said. He must ride to Bravellir in a wagon, and was well nigh blind. He died like a man. Guest nodded and spoke no further, but busied himself with the food. They ate wordlessly. Afterward they slaked their thirst anew at the spring, and went aside, left and right, to piss. When Starkad came back to the fire, he found Guest already there, squatting on his haunches. The night was wholly upon them. Thor's wain gleamed enormous, barely over treetops, the north star higher like a spear-point. Starkad loomed above the fire, legs astraddle, fists on hips, and nearly snarled, Too long have you slyly fended me off, you. What do you want? Out with it, or I'll hew you down. Guest looked up. The light slipped to and fro along the shadows in his face. "A last question," he said. "Then you shall know. When were you born, Starkad?" The giant coughed forth a curse. "You ask and ask and ask, and naught do you give. What kind of being are you? You sit on your hams like a Finnish warlock."
Guest shook his head.
"I learned this much farther east," he replied mildly, "and many things else, but none of them are wizardry. You learned womanishness, you who took care to arrive late at the battlefield and stood by while I fought 6 men. Guest rose, straightened his back, stared across the flames, and said in a voice like steel sliding from sheath, "That was no war of mine, nor would I have hunted men who boded me no further harm." In the dim and restless light, under the stars and winter road, suddenly he seemed of a tallness with the warrior, or in some way taller still. "A thing I heard said about you is that though you be foremost in battle, you are doomed to do ill deeds, Nithing's work, over and over and over. They say Thor laid this on you because he hates you. They say the god who bears you good will is Odin, father of witchcraft. Could this be true?" The giant gasped. It was as if he shrank back. He raised hands and thrust at air. "Empty talk," he groaned. "Not more." Guest's words tramped against him. "But you have done treacheries. How many in those lifetimes that have been yours?" "Hold your jaw," Starkad bellowed. "What know you of being ageless? Be still, ere I smite you like the dayfly you are." "That might not be so easy," Guest purred. "I too have lived a long time, far longer than you, my friend." The breath rattled in Starkad's throat. He could merely gape. Guest's tone went dry. "Well, nobody in these parts would keep count of years, as they do in the south or the east. What I heard was that you have lived 3 men's lifetimes. That must mean simply that folk remember their grandfathers telling of you. 100 years is a good enough guess."
"I have thought it was more."
Again Guest's eyes caught Starkad's and held them. His voice softened but bleakened, trembled the least bit, like a night breeze. "I know not myself how old I am, but when I was a boy they did not yet ken metal in these lands. Of stone did we make our knives, our axe heads and spear heads and arrow heads, our burial chambers. It was not Jotuns who raised those dolmens that brood over the land. It was us, your own forebears, laying our dead to rest and offering to our gods, though we are no more. I have outlived them, I alone, as I have outlived all the generations of men after, until today, Starkad." "You have grayed," said the warrior in a kind of sob, as if that could be a denial. "I went gray in my young manhood. Some do, you know. Otherwise I have not changed. I have never been sick, and wounds heal swiftly without scars. When my teeth wear out, new ones grow. Is it the same for you?" Starkad gulped and nodded. "Belike you've taken more hurts than me, such a life as you've led," said Guest thoughtfully. "Myself, I've been as peaceful as men let me be, and as careful as a roamer may. When the charioteers rode into what these days we call Denmark," he scowled, "that is forgotten, their wars and their deeds and their very speech. Wisdom lasts. It is what I have sought across the world." Starkad shuddered. "Guest," he mumbled, "I remember now in my own youth there went tales of a wayfarer who—"
"Norna, Guest. Are you he? I thought he was but a story.
Often have I left the north for hundreds of years. Always it called me home again. My last stay here ended maybe 40 years ago. Less of an absence than formerly, but—" Once more Guest sighed. "I feel myself grow ever wearier of roving the earth among the winds. So folk remembered me for a while, did they? Starkad shook his head dazedly. And to think that I was alive then. But I must have been faring about. Is it true that the Norns told your mother you would die when a candle burned down, and she snuffed it out, and you carry it still? Guest grinned. Do you yourself believe you have your lifespan from Odin? He turned grave. I know not what has made us twain what we are. That is a riddle as dark as the death of all other mankind. Norns or gods, in truth? The hunger to know drove me to the far ends of the world, that and the hope of finding more like myself. Oh, seeing a beloved wife wither into the grave, and seeing our children follow her. But nowhere did I come on any else whom time spares, nor did I come on any answer. Rather, I heard too many answers. I met too many gods. Abroad they call on Christ, but if you fare southward long enough, it is Muhammad. And eastward it is Gautama Buddha, save where they say the world is a dream of Brahm, or offer to a host of gods and ghosts and elves like ours in these northlands. And almost every man I asked told me that his folk know the truth, while the rest are benighted. Could I but hear a word I felt even half sure of. "Fret not yourself about that," said Starkad, boldness rising anew in him. "Things are whatever they are, and no man shuns his doom. His freedom is to leave a high name behind him. I wondered if I was altogether alone, and my deathlessness a curse laid on me for some horrible guilt I have forgotten," Guest went on. "That seemed wrong, though. Strange births do happen. Oftenest they are weak or crippled. But now and then something springs up that can flourish like a clover with four leaves. Could we ageless be such? We would be very few. Most could well die of war or mischance before discovering they are different. Others could well be slain by neighbors who come to fear they are witches. Or they may flee, take new names, learn how to hide what they are. I have mostly done this, seldom abiding at length in any single place. Once in a while I have met folk who were willing to take me for what I am, wise men in the east, or raw backwoods dwellers like my northerners. But in the end there was always too much sorrow, too heavy a freight of memories, and I must leave them also. Never did I find my own sort. Many and many a trail did I follow, sometimes for years, but each led to naught. At last hope faded out of me, and I turned my footsteps homeward. At least the northern springtime is forever young. And then I heard about you. Guest came around the fire. He reached to lay hands on Starkad's shoulders. "Here my quest ends where it began," he said. Tears trembled on his lashes. "Now we are two, no more alone. And by this we know there must be more. Women among them. Together, helping and heartening each other, we can search till we begin to find. Starkad, my brother." The warrior stood unmoving before he said, "This comes suddenly." Guest let go. "It does that. I've had the whole while to think since the first word I got about you. Well, take your time. We have more time than most men, you and I." Starkad stared off into the dark. "I thought some day I must grow old and strengthless like Harald," he breathed. "Unless first I fell in battle, and I thought I would see to it that I did. But you tell me I shall always be young. Always." "A load that on me has often felt well-nigh unbearable," Guest told him. "Shared, though, it will be light." Starkad clenched oak-burl fists. "What shall we do with it? Ward the gift well. It may, after all, be from beyond, and those who bear it singled out for deeds that will change the world." "Yes." Glee began to throb in Starkad's voice. "Fame undying, and I alive to enjoy it. War hosts to rally round me, kingdoms to take, royal houses to found. Hold, hold.
said Guest. "We're not gods, you know. We can be slain, drowned, burned, starved like any other men. I've stayed on Earth these uncounted years by ganging warily." Sarkad gave him a cold look. Scorn snorted. "I understand that. Do you understand honor? I don't mean we should skulk. Let us make sure of our safety, both in strength and in bolt holes, lest luck go awry. After that we can make known what we are, piece by piece, to such folk as we can trust. There all of us will help. But that is not enough. To lead, we must serve. We must give. How can we give unless we have gold, treasures, a hoard such as deathless Vikings can heap up?" Guest frowned. "We draw near to quarreling. Best we speak no further tonight, but sleep on it. Tomorrow, refreshed, we'll think more clearly."
"You can sleep after this?"
"What, are you not worn out?" Starkad laughed. "After reaping a goodly harvest." He failed to see how Guest winced. "As you wish.
To bed."
However, in the shelter he thrashed and muttered and flung his arms around. Finally, Guest slipped back outside. He found a dry spot close to the spring, but decided he would take his rest in meditation rather than sleep. Having assumed the lotus position, he raised calm within himself. That came easily. He had far surpassed his gurus in lands east of the sunrises over Denmark, for he had had centuries to practice the disciplines of mind and body that they taught. Yet without those teachings, he doubted he could have endured his lot. How fared those masters, those fellow Kalas? Had Nadha or Lobsang at last won free of the wheel? Would he ever? Hope bound him. He could never quite bring himself to loosen it. Did that mean he spurned the faith? Om Mani Padme Hum. No such words had seized him by the soul. But was that because he would not let them? Could he only find a god to whom he could yield? At least he had become like the sages in control of the body and its passions. Rather, in this he had won to the power for which they had striven. Breath and heartbeat dwindled at his command until he was unaware of them. Chill ceased to be a thing invading his skin. He was of it. He was the night world. He became the stave that unfolded. Slowly the moon slides aloft. Keen is its edge. Cutting the dark. Stars and frost. As still as the dead. Worn of another waning year. A noise recalled him. Hours had passed. The east stood gray above the trees. Dew spread the only brightness in a hueless half-light. Mist smoked above it, and along men's breath. The clear gurgle of the spring sounded much louder than it was. Starkad hunched at the shelter. He had knocked it apart, blundering out. He carried the sheathed sword that had lain across his doffed mail. A bloodshot and dark-rimmed gaze jumped about until it landed on Guest. He grunted and stalked that way. Guest rose. "Good morning," he greeted. "Did you spend the night sitting?" Starkad wondered. His voice grated. "Sleep fled me, too. I hope you got some rest anyway. I'll go see what's in the snares. Wait, ere I take more at your hands." Cold pierced Guest from within. "What's wrong?" "You. Your slippery tongue. I tossed as in a nightmare, fighting to grasp what you meant yesterday. Now you'll make it plain to me." "Why, I thought I did. We are two ageless men. Our loneliness is at an end. But there must be others, women among them, for us to find and hold dear. For this we'll swear oaths, become brothers." "Of what kind?" rasped Starkad. "I the chieftain, later the king, you my scald and reedsman. But that's not what you said." He swallowed. "Or do you also want to be a king?" Brightening. "Surely, we can divide the world between us." "We would die trying. Our fame will never die. Or worse,
we would fall out with each other. How shall two stay together when always they deal in death and betrayal? At once Guest saw his mistake. He had intended to say that such was the nature of power. Seizing it and holding it were alike filthy. But before he could go on, Starkad clapped hand to hilt. The rocky face went dawn pale.
"So you besmirch my honor," he said from the bottom of his gullet.
Guest lifted a hand, palm outward.
"No, let me explain."
Starkad leaned close. His nostrils flared.
"What have you heard about me? Spew it out."
Guest knew starkly that he must. "They tell how you took one small king captive and hanged him for an offering to Odin, after you had promised him his life. They tell how you murdered another in his bathhouse, for pay. But I had to," Starkad yelled. "Ever was I an outsider. The rest were too young, and..." He uttered a bawl like an aurochs bull's. "And your loneliness lashed you till you struck back blindly," Guest said. "I understand. I did when first I heard about you. How often have I felt thus? I remember deeds of mine that hurt me worse than fire. It's merely that I am not a killer." Starkad spat on the ground. "Right. You've hugged your years to you like a crone wrapping herself in her blanket. But don't you see," Guest cried, "things have changed for us both. Now we've better work to do than attack folk who never harmed us. It was the lust for fame, wealth, power that brought you to dishonor." Starkad screamed. His sword flew free. He hewed. Guest shifted like a shadow. Nonetheless, the edge ripped down his left arm. Blood poured forth, drenched the cloth, dripped into the streamlet that ran from the spring. He drifted back, drew his knife, halted in half a crouch. Starkad stood fast.
"I should chop you in twain for what you said," he panted, gulping air. "But I think you will die soon enough of that stroke."
Laughter clanked. "A shame. I did hope you'd be a friend, the first real friend of my life. Well, the Norns will it otherwise." "Our natures do," Guest thought. "And how easily I could kill you. How open you stand to 100 martial tricks, I know." "Instead, I shall have to go on as erstwhile," said Starkad, "alone." "Let it be so," thought Guest. With the fingers of his right hand he searched below his torn shirt and pushed together the lips of his wound. Pain he made into something apart from himself, like the mists that broke under the strengthening light. He gave his mind to the blood flow. Starkad kicked the shelter aside, fetched his mail, drew it over the underpadding in which he had spent the night. He donned coif and helmet, belted on sword, picked up shield. When he was ready to leave, he stared in astonishment at the other man.
"What, are you still on your feet?" he said. "Shall I make an end of you?"
End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.